We're going to call the tax commissioner, or remember, thanks for waiting patiently. We don't know where the commissioner is, so we hear he's coming, but so people don't have to keep waiting. We tried to talk to Mr. Willett in the Department of Revenue to walk through the governor's property tax proposal, but he didn't want to. He left. No, there he is. So now we've got Mr. Loftus, so we figured maybe he could do the green jobs. We could get that piece done while we're waiting for the commissioner. So if members are okay with that, and Mr. Loftus, just 1 minute. We do have a quorum. Could somebody move? We have 3 sets of minutes here.
I'll move, Madam Chair.
President David moves all 3 minutes. Discussion for the 3 sets of minutes.
Let the record reflect.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion carries. Thank you for that, Mr. Representative David. And Mr. Loftus, thank you. And we'll just kind of clue Commissioner Heinisch into what you're doing when he gets here. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Mark Loftus from Deed. I will talk about the Green Job Z portion of the governor's bill. It is very similar in concept to the existing Job Z program, but it has some significant differences. One is that in part the Job Z benefits would be entirely focused on companies that are identified as green, and there will be a definition of the bill that is identifies those green businesses that will match very closely to the definition that was in the that will be in the Green Job Task Force report that was I think unveiled today. So we've been following that work closely, and green job benefits would be available to those types of companies. It would also be similar in terms of the tax benefits that are being exempted from tax. The one exception we'll make to that is the motor vehicle excise tax that's currently in Job Z that companies are exempt from. It was found to be very difficult for revenue to determine whether a truck or a piece of or a vehicle is otherwise subject to tax should be exempt because it's located in the zone or outside the zone where it's used. So we've made that one little change in the Green Job Z proposal. In other respects, the program is a little bit different. First of all, the proposal is that there be 12 years of exemption for any project that signs an agreement through the end of December 2015. So if you sign an agreement in the end of 2015, you would have 12 full years after that. The other difference is that it would be available anywhere in the state. So whereas the existing Job Z program is in 85 Greater Minnesota counties, the Green Jobs program could be available anywhere. We are also not starting the program with the designation of large zones as we did with the first Jobs program. Instead, we are following the model that we are now using with our administration of Jobs to approve specific projects as they come in. So, the city would be working with a company that they believe is a qualified green business. They would submit an application to us, and we would analyze that in terms of the return on investment, whether there's competition with other businesses in the area, whether it qualifies under the Green Job Z program. So that's a big difference in the existing Job Z program as it was originally constituted. In many ways, it matches up with the way we're administering Job Z now. We haven't had a chance to talk in committee yet about how we're dealing with Job Z today, Madam Chair, but I think Representative Marquardt has a summary that he provided to members. We talked about how we're administering it. So we're looking at every project case by case and approving it. And we're signing a business subsidy agreement with the company, the state is, along with local government. So we've made significant changes in response to the discussion that we had last session about the program. But the cost of Green Job Z, as you see on the change item page, is $3.65 million over the 10-11 biennium and $6.6 million over the 12-13 biennium. That's based on an estimate of a kind of a prototypical project that we brought worked on with revenue. It estimates about 5 projects in the first year in 10, and then 10 projects thereafter in 11, 12, 13, 12, and 13. That is far smaller number than we had in the original Job Z program. The first year of original Job Z, we had 110 projects in 2004. Last year we had 27 statewide. So I think that it illustrates that we are being more selective, both in terms of the green technology businesses, as well as making sure that these are companies that truly need the benefits of the Job Z program. So that's a quick summary, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Loftus, I'm curious, in reading through the potential benefits, companies that create energy, manufacturing, that sort of thing, would this include like a seabed project that's putting up towers and windmills and creating a wind farm? Would that be one of the companies that would be eligible?
Madam Chair, Representative Zemmer, yes it is. Renewable energy production would count, so a wind farm could be exempt under that circumstance.
Representative Zemmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, how about, would this, and I don't know, we don't have a kind of detail here in terms of exactly which taxes they wouldn't have to be paying, but would it cover, for example, the wind production energy tax? Would they be exempt from that in addition to sales taxes, income taxes, and all the other things? Can you talk a little bit about the differences in taxes they may be exempt from that may be different than the job depot
tax? Mr. Loftus.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, in the case of a wind turbine farm, the wind production tax is also exempt, should there be a project that would have a wind turbine that they're producing energy from. We haven't done an analysis of that type of project specifically, but I could imagine that the income tax portion, property tax exemption that wind farm would pay would be, I should take that back. Probably the largest part would be the sales tax. Sales tax on construction materials would be, as we found under existing jobs, the 38% of all the exemptions were taken in the sales tax on the construction side. So probably in relative proportion, we can take a look at that if you like and see where that might fall within that type of project, but maybe the sales tax would be the largest share.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that brings up a question, actually, when you mentioned the property tax part, because my understanding is that the wind production energy tax is there because the towers don't add value, so they shouldn't be included in any property tax increase. It'd be interesting in seeing if there's any property tax increase, any property tax increase that we wouldn't be getting factored into the savings, because that was my understanding. That's why we have the wind production energy tax, if I'm understanding that correctly. Because, again, it doesn't add to the property tax base, therefore, because it's capital equipment, it's not part of the property. So I don't know if there'd be any property tax savings other than on the property the windmill sits on, huh? Something like that.
Madam Chair, Representative Zimmer, we'll take a look at that. We haven't examined that type of project specifically. Most of our approach with the Green Job Z has been on the idea that we're trying to either retain companies that are producing a green manufacturing type of product, like a gearbox or a wind turbine or wind turbine blades, for example, or a supply chain business as part of that. We've looked less at the renewable energy wind side, but we'll take a look at that and see how that might apply.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, it's a follow-up question to some of your earlier comments, but years ago, early 90s, I was quite involved in the wind energy issue. Would you have the capability with that kind of a tax break to prioritize? The reason I'm asking that question, there were some parts of the state that were potentially very productive for wind energy and others that were marginal, would be even though in some of the marginal areas some were interested in, I suppose, experimenting with the technology, but potential just wasn't that big. Surfaced on a couple of colleges and university campuses that were interested, so they would, of course, be tax-exempt anyway, but just that general question, can you prioritize, or would everybody that wanted to engage the production of wind energy be qualified?
Mr. Loftus.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, as constituted, the program would allow those wind turbine farms to be exempt. I think the decision that we have to make as a State Department in reviewing each of these projects is the exemption necessary for that project to go forward. So maybe there is a project where the tax benefit would help install that equipment and bring that turbine online in a way that if in another part of the state it would not require that subsidy through Job Z. That's the kind of calculation and an examination that we intend to make as we go forward. You're absolutely right. There are parts of the state where, and I know of a couple where they've tried to put up a turbine and didn't have the wind flow and of the duration that they needed to make that work. But we certainly aren't going to allow the exemptions for projects that are otherwise marginal and can't compete with the production that they need to have.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Loftus, I guess I want to continue with that line of discussion a little bit more because I was going to ask, you know, for more of the rationale for this. And you know, I like the idea, but I just, in the situation we're in, I guess I feel like any expenditure that we make, we better make sure that we are making it, you know, for a really good reason and that we have really good evidence that it's going to pay off for us. And so I'm kind of wondering, what I thought I heard you just saying was that you're going to kind of decide on a case-by-case basis whether it's worth it for various projects. And I'd just kind of like to know a little bit more what the evidence is on which you're going to base these decisions and, you know, what the rationale is generally right now because, I mean, we do have a renewable energy standard, and I think that helps right there, that the utilities need to be buying more and more energy, and I think that has spurred a lot of growth in this sector. But maybe you could just talk a little bit more about, you know, what evidence you're using for these kinds of decisions.
Mr. Ma.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I have information that our staff have been working with this in terms of prospects in all of these sectors, all of these green technology sectors. We have currently a pipeline of 45 projects, and many of these are existing Minnesota companies or potential companies, but a lot of them are companies that are located outside Minnesota currently, where they're a national firm that we're working with that might be producing gearboxes for the wind turbines or blades or some other electronics, or they might be some type of solar power, solar panel manufacturing. There's 45 projects that represent $330 million in those total projects with 1,200 jobs potentially. Now that's the potential, but that's our pipeline of companies we're working with. And the best example of the kind of company that we're trying to work with is one, as we go forward with Green Jobs, is one we worked with over the last year. And that's a company that I think I've talked to some of you about, but a business that will be a Finnish company that will be located in Faribault when they begin construction. We hope that occurs this spring or summer, to produce gearboxes for the wind turbines. And those housings at the top of the turbine, if you've seen them up close, are the size of a school bus. Well, the components inside of those are probably bigger than this desk, the gearboxes themselves. And that was a project that was in play in Minnesota and Iowa. A Finnish company had to make the decision to locate. They are in this facility. They will be supplying the turbine manufacturing that occurs in Iowa at the Oxion Spanish wind turbine company. So they'd be in their supply chain. And they had to make a decision where to put that facility. And in that process, we pulled out everything, including the kitchen sink, to help them locate this in Minnesota. These Finnish company people were persuaded ultimately with the workforce and the infrastructure and the access to the quality research coming out of the university as they go forward and the engineering, that all of those factors helped make the decision in favor of Minnesota. But the factor that they would tell you if they were here to testify is that the Job Z benefits, existing Job Z benefits that we already have, would turn the tide for their decision in favor of Minnesota over the site in Iowa. Now, I know that raises the specter of companies foot loose and moving around and bartering against state one state over and the other to make incentive decisions, but it's kind of the reality of the life we lead in economic development. And my job description and that of our department is to try to have development occur in Minnesota. And we did everything we could to have them succeed with that project in Minnesota. So that's an example of the type of company we're kind of the epitome. If they could all be like that, that would be great. I'm not sure we'll always be so clear cut, but that's the kind of decision making that we're going through as we use the Green Jobs Z program or propose it to try to help win projects in Minnesota.
Thank you. Ms. Sullivan, are you done?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just, I guess that kind of begs the question of then why only green type of companies? I mean, I love that, but, you know, why only them? Because under that rationale, there doesn't seem to be anything special about the fact that they're clean energy or anything like that.
Mr. Loftus.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I would put on my Thomas Friedman hat to answer that question. The idea that the world is hot, slab, and crowded, as his book identified, and the fact that we kind of have a two-prong problem here. We have an environmental problem and a need to produce more renewable energy. We also have a green, we have a job creation problem in this country, too. This opportunity here is kind of a nexus between those two. We can create environmentally friendly production and renewable energy development, but we can also create jobs around that. So that's kind of behind, we haven't talked too much about that behind the governor's initiative here, but in terms of the green jobs element, there's a synthesis between those two purposes and interests that we have in the public model. And I should say too, green jobs, we'll work with any kind of company that will create jobs in the state. So it just happens that the Moventus project would qualify as a green tech type of business, but certainly green isn't the only type of thing that can help us through this economy.
Okay, Representative Lanning, then Loeffler, then Reiner. Representative Lanning.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Loeffler, I take it on what you said that green is defined more broadly than just renewable energy being considered green. To give you an example of, I'm trying to get at how broadly we might define this, and I would hope that it would be any development that would be considered environmentally friendly. I can think of an industry that I'm aware of right now that has a new process for dealing with hazardous waste, regular household waste, as well as hazardous waste that would be an alternative to incineration and landfill. Is that the kind of thing that might be eligible for this green job Z?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, yes, it is, and that would fit into the fourth category that we, as kind of to summarize these, we see them as first renewable energy, second industrial products or consumer products that are green related and help support green development, or building products for, such as windows and doors and panels that are more green friendly. So that's kind of another category. Green services, environmental remediation, and technology, and services to consumers and businesses. But that fourth category would be environmental conservation, environmental monitoring, compliance, environmental reduction. In fact, before I came to the hearing this afternoon, I met with a company that's developing a product to remove, I can't remember the chemicals from water, but it's a new technology in rural areas where there is arsenic and other chemicals that are often found in rural wells and tend to end up in the groundwater. So that's the kind of company also that would qualify. So yes, to your example, yes, that would qualify.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Loftus. Still trying to get my hand around sort of what green and what qualifies and how you're going to evaluate that. And you know, I represent an area that has had an industrial past, and we're still dealing with some manufacturing chaos. I mean, I know when the thermal oxidizer isn't working in a plant near my home, and that's not considered very green by my neighbors. And, you know, buildings, reuse of buildings is a very green way to go as opposed to building new construction. So if a project we're going to propose using an existing facility and making sure that it was conservative, would that get higher ratings than building something new? I know someone who's done some energy audits on some large entities, and their biggest non-green impact, I mean, they looked at their heating and lighting and all the other sort of building envelope thing, and the biggest problem they had was the huge amounts of you know, parking lot space that they had. And so, you know, I'm hoping that as we're looking at evaluating these projects, are you intending to look at the total carbon impact, the total green impact, or is it only just the end use of whatever product or service is provided.
Mr. Lofler.
Madam Chair, Representative Lofler, I can't say that we've gone real far in that kind of calculation as to the carbon footprint. We focus more on the type of business work that they're doing. So, for example, if a company said, well, we want tax benefits because we may not be a green business by our definition of producing green products, but we're going into a building that has a reduced carbon footprint because it has a better insulation or solar power or something, for example, that wouldn't be the intent of Job Z in the sense of our administration. There may be other proposals this session that the Green Jobs Task Force will bring forward on building retrofitting, environmental improvements in existing buildings, and tax credits for that purpose. I haven't been closely following that, but we're focusing more on the type of companies that will be able to attract to the state and keep in the state, but for the benefits of Job Z. So there may be other ways to accomplish the purpose that you're talking about, Representative Lofler.
Madam Chair, as we decide who is worthy and who not is not worthy of significant tax benefits, I think we really have to hone in on how we're going to make that value choice, because that, in particular when you're expecting the competition to be very strong, and I would love to have follow-up information on when you're contacted by someone from another state, when you play that matchmaking role, I suspect there's, 700 of the 855 cities who might say, yeah, put it in my backyard if it's really going to offer good living wage jobs. And so I'm hoping that as you refine this proposal, you'll get us a lot more detail about how you're going to decide who is worthy of this break and who isn't, because that will decide, I think for many of us, whether it's a fair competition.
Madam Chair, Representative Lofler, that's a very good point, and frankly, farther than we are today, so we'll take that into consideration.
Thank you. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I have two questions. Mr. Lofler, so my questions really aren't around the green aspect as much as they are around the Job Z aspect, but as we look at potentially, modeling a new program along those lines, now one of the things that in Northeastern Minnesota we saw with the original Job Z was not really any real addition to the tax base. In fact, we saw, because of some businesses moving around, a reduction of the tax base. And I know the legislative auditor came out with some recommendations and some changes were made. Do you feel like we learned enough from that program to replicate a new program based on that same model?
Madam Chair, Representative Reinert, I should have mentioned this earlier, but one of the principles of the Green Job Z program is that we will not allow relocations, period, within the state. So companies say, well, we want to expand and we want to relocate, but we're going to expand in the process. That will not be permitted under Green Job Z.
Thank you, Mr. Loftus. Madam Chair, second follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Loftus, my second question is, the other change that to me at least is significant is the statewide application versus just a Greater Minnesota application. I'm wondering if you could address that.
Madam Chair, Representative Reiner, the point of that is that we're trying not to be geographic specific about where these projects might be. If their best location is in International Falls or Moorhead or South Minneapolis or the east side of St. Paul, we want that company to make that choice based on the examination of that location to serve their business best, not more of the rural focus of the original Job Z program.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lofler, for pen setting, for Commissioner who's here, and I think we've finished the green Job Z unless there's a further question. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lofler. Welcome, Commissioner. Commissioner, we tried to get Mr. Ouellette to do property tax, but he just didn't really want to. So we haven't done that yet. And what do we have left in the business bucket? We've got capital equipment up front, which most members, I think, get that one. Section 179, people get that one. The capital gains exemption, which is a little new. Can you kind of do those three and get through them so we can get to the public testimony on the business chunk before we start the property tax part? I think that's the better way, because we've had some people who've been sitting here from the business community
for a number of days, and in fact, Ms. Bergman just figured it out for me, February 4th, February 10th, February 11th, and February 16th. This is the fourth full hearing on the governor's tax proposal, and I'm glad for that, Commissioner, and we are still not done, but we just want to make sure that everybody understands everything the governor is proposing. But may I ask you before you begin, what is the plan for you for revenue now that we, you know, we've seen at least the initial scratchings, I guess, of President Obama's stimulus package, and many of the items, or not many, but some of these items, in fact, President Obama has them. He increases Section 179. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on in the green economy. There's other, you know, investor credits. And so I would argue, Commissioner, we don't need to do them here at the state level, too, but that's just me. Will you be bringing forward a new proposal from the governor on how he's going to change all these things now that the Congress has doing them? Or, you know, how will you just kind of react holistically to the fact that all of this even is in flux again? Commissioner.
Right. Madam Chair, it's a very relevant question. Dr. Wilson has actually started doing an analysis on everything that was in the stimulus package. And in conjunction with the issuance of the supplemental budget, and I expect somewhere in mid-March, those changes will be made. So we'll, first and foremost, we'll find out what the Fed did, what impact that will have on our revenue stream. It looks like when a first blush look at it, Madam Chair, appears as if most of what they did will not have an adverse impact on Minnesota revenues. They did it in tax credits and things that we don't necessarily have to conform to. And so it looks like it might be a fairly modest impact. But you're right, 179 expensing, the cap was lifted, I think, to $250,000. The question will be, does the governor want to fully conform to that higher cap, or does he want to stay at where he's at in his current budget, which is $139,000, I believe? So those decisions will have to be made based on what the revenue impact would be after our research department and Dr. Wilson rescores those. But we do got a memo, a very preliminary memo, about all the tax provisions that were passed, and Dr. Wilson's initial blush on which ones we have to be concerned about as far as having a positive or a negative revenue impact on the department. So it'll probably be something post-February forecast, what I would expect. And we would incorporate any changes into the governor's supplemental budget.
Okay. Thank you. And so, Commissioner, you think you can get through these last three, and then we can go to the public testimony?
Madam Chair, I sincerely hope so. I'm cautiously optimistic. The first one is the capital equipment upfront exemption, and I think most on this committee are very familiar with this provision. As we all know, currently there's a full exemption for the purchase of capital equipment. Regrettably, businesses have to apply to the Department of Revenue in order to get that 6.5% exemption. Currently, we get about 98% of them out in 90 days. Actually, about half of them go out in 30 days, are called quick refunds. But we'd like to get out of the business entirely of doing this, and I think the business community would embrace that. It's mainly an impediment or an issue for smaller businesses. It's a cash flow issue. It's an administrative issue. And it's been a long time we've talked about it. The revenue impact is not insignificant. It's about $77 million in the first biennium. But I think it's something that's long overdue. I think we've had this for 12 years now, this refund process in place. And so the governor is now recommending to eliminate that and go to an upfront exemption. The next provision in the governor's budget is just Section 179 expensing, so conforming to that provision in federal law. I stand corrected that we are conforming to a $133,000 amount. As I said to the chair just now, that is going up in the bill that just passed and signed into law. So we'll have to do some analysis of whether we want to conform that higher amount. And I believe it's $250,000. So I don't know if the revenue estimate is. I don't know if that will double the revenue estimate, but you know it might be something close to that. So it'll be a significant revenue impact, at least in the first 2 years. And that's the 179 expensing. It primarily benefits smaller businesses, because there's a phase out of the exemption of the expensing amount once you reach a certain level of investment. So it's primarily targeted at small and medium-sized businesses. The next one, as the Madam Chair alluded to, is a very surgical and focused capital gains exemption. This provision would actually be targeted at employees under 100 people, and it would provide a 50% exemption for investment equity investments in those type of businesses. And it's another effort by the governor to try to pull some levers to incent investment in smaller businesses. And you saw that the Small Business Investment Act was one lever. The Angel Investment Credit was another lever. This is another one. Now, we've heard from smaller businesses, they want to invest in their own business, or they have investors in their hometown who want to invest, and they think having some sort of capital gains exclusion would be an incentive for that. The reason why there's no cost in the budgetary horizon here is that it actually requires a five-year holding period, so you have to be somewhat of a long-term investor to get the benefit of the tax benefit. But it's something we're interested in, and we've been having some feedback on it as well. It's a new creature. It's not something we've proposed before. And so I would say it's a work in progress, but we put something on the table we think has some real merit, and we'd like to have further discussion on it. And I think, Madam Chair, that concludes the nonprofit tax provisions.
So we do want to take public testimony now from anybody who wants to talk to us about all the business provisions from the corporate tax cut on to what we just finished on. But before, as someone's coming down, please, Representative Dellers has a very special guest here, and I'd like to ask Representative Dellers to introduce that guest at this time. Representative Dellers.
Well, Madam Chair, you got me in big trouble. My darling wife, Kim, is joining me today. School is out, but if you wanted to continue your education course here in the tax committee, and I asked if you could sit up in my office and do work, she said, no, I want to come and see the tax committee. So she should get all the credit in the world for coming and listening to some of our discussions. She wasn't here during the, as Representative Coles points out, for putting up with me on a daily basis. But wasn't here for the pay today, so I don't know if she has a full impact of how slow we can really make the wheels work. But thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and welcome. We're glad you're here. We have to put up with them here, and we know you have to at home, so, you know, we're glad you're here today. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm appearing today on behalf of my client, Life Science Alley, with my partner, Linda Sandvig, who's also in the back of the room with us. We appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. We'd like to testify on behalf of the presentation proposals that the commissioner has talked about on angel investor tax credits. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, I will be very brief. We support the ideas that the governor has put in his bill. We strongly believe that the state needs to provide some incentives to keep projects going that hit what we call the valley of death when you're moving out of the medical device or the biopharmaceutical world and trying to get some funding. Often there is an ability to find personal funding, to find family funding, but to move to that next step where we really need to go is something that have been working at. And as members of this committee know, and the chair is aware, we passed that legislation as a part of last year's tax bill, which was unfortunately vetoed, and we're back again this year supporting it. We have two minor provisions that we have disagreements with the department and the governor on, and we're working to try and fix those. One of those is a provision within the governor's proposal that requires that these be regional in terms of the investment. And we believe strongly that if somebody in Wilmer wants to invest in something in Duluth, they ought to be able to do that, and the money will flow in directions that it should. And for that reason, we would like to see that be a change as that legislation moves forward. We also believe that it would be wise to have these investments made on an individual basis, not just through funds. And we are urging the department and the governor to reconsider that limitation in their proposal. As members may remember, Representative Dabney has helped us with a bill that became a part of the tax bill last year, and we'll work with him. I believe his bill was introduced today, but I haven't had an opportunity yet to look at the introductions, and we'll continue to work with Representative Dabney on those. And, Madam Chair, those are our brief comments on this proposal. We are understanding, as you all are, of the difficulties that we are going to have this year in terms of funding, and we don't make these proposals lightly. We've seriously considered them. I direct to the committee, too, and I will provide you with copies of a press release that came out from our neighbors on Friday. Wisconsin's in a similar budget situation, but the governor just proposed an increase in their taxes, and that press release talks about the $147 million in additional investment that they've had by angel investors over the last 2 years in Wisconsin by having that type of tax credit, and we believe it would be a good thing for Minnesota to follow. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just add one other thing. Last week, the chair said that we needed to keep these ideas separate and not mix up our tax credits and things, and we'd like to do the same thing in the lobbying community. The chair pointed out that there were those people that were paid and those people that weren't paid to be here. There's another category, and I'd like to be in it, and my colleagues would as well, and those of us that are not paid nearly enough to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Questions? Anyone? No? Thank you. We appreciate you waiting and you know the debate will rage on, so thank you for being here. Further public testimony? Yes, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cassidy with Leonard Street and Diner. I'm here on behalf of two clients, actually a coalition of clients, Advantage Capital and Enhanced Capital, which are supporting the idea in Governor Valenti's proposal on the Small Business Investment Tax Credit. The tax credit, although it's smaller than what we're proposing, is conceptually the same idea, and that is contained in House File 475. It's being authored by Representative Winkler, and I think by a number of people on the table here. But hopefully I'll be able to answer more questions when that bill arrives in committee here. But I want to get to some questions that were brought up last week when Commissioner Ines was testifying, and a couple of things. First of all, it's the issue of what incentives are in the bill for this program to succeed and to carry on into the future. Number one, if this program doesn't succeed after 4 years, when the tax credits come due, the program won't be reauthorized. Insurers will collect their tax credits, and after the tax credits run out, the program won't come back. In other states where this is this program has been implemented and passed into law, the program has been very successful. It's been reauthorized a number of times. I think Commissioner Ines has talked and spoke to the states of Texas, Missouri, New York, all of which have had very much success with it. There's a couple of states that are looking at putting this very same program, the Small Business Investment Tax Credit, into their economic stimulus packages. And it's enjoyed a very, very good track record over the years and has been improved upon over the years. I'd also like to say that right now, obviously, Mr. Griffith addressed the issue of the valley of death for some of these small companies. I think the one thing to consider is that there is no capital out there. You don't have it. No one else has it. Insurers have it. Insurers have reserves. They have reserves that have to be invested. We should go after those reserves and give them incentive to put those dollars on the street and make that capital work for our small businesses in the state of Minnesota and not in other states. This tax credit would provide that kind of incentive. The other thing I'd like to point out is that if you implemented this program either under the governor's proposal or under our proposal, it would be a 60% or an 80% tax credit. You'd be the first state in the country that's done this program for less than 100% tax credit. So it'd be much less than what other states have done in the past. Finally, I'll leave you with a couple of other thoughts. Representative Carlson had a couple of questions with regard to what are benchmarks in the program, what do you have to meet in order for the program to succeed, how are you going to measure how it succeeds. Representative Marquardt also had the same question, and that is, number one, the investment advisors in this program are private investors. They have to go out on the streets. They have to hustle with money, get it into small businesses, make it work, and they have to report every year to the legislature and to the commissioner of deed and to the governor where the program's at, where the money's been invested, how many employees have been hired, how much revenue has been generated, what's the follow-on capital. Probably one of the most important things as it relates to incentivizing capital is that the initial investment, what does it trigger after that? What kind of new capital comes into those businesses? And finally, after 4 years, you'll know. This program doesn't kick in until 2013. Which means we don't pay for it till then. Hopefully by 2013 the program will have paid for itself, an additional tax revenue and additional job growth in the state of Minnesota. With that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Questions? Thank you, and thank you for sitting through a couple of meetings. But we'll continue on this one, too. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just want to focus your attention on four items in the governor's budget proposal: capital equipment, the corporate rate reduction, Small Business Investment Act, which Mr. Cassidy just talked about, and the Section 179 expensing. Capital equipment has been an issue that the Chamber has supported for many, many years. I think it goes all the way back to a sales tax advisory council of 1994 or 95, where it was suggested that it really should be an upfront exemption. There's no real need once the rate on replacement capital equipment fell to zero for the department to audit the results and have this refund program. It is administratively burdensome. It is especially important, as Mr. Ines said, for small companies, but it's important to all manufacturers that purchase equipment. It also, I think, has the opportunity to redeploy some positions within the Department of Revenue away from the sales tax audit function to other areas, so that you also should consider while debating this proposal. Second, the corporate income tax rate reduction. I think this is really an important feature of the governor's budget. It's important because it addresses one of the areas where Minnesota is an outlier. I think you've heard over and over about the high corporate income tax rate in this state, and especially when it's combined with the federal rate. That does impact investment decisions. There was some academic research discussed at the governor's 21st Century Tax Reform Commission, where foreign direct investment in the state falls as the corporate income tax rate increases, and it wasn't the effective rate; it was the statutory rate. Also, corporate income taxes, by the research, shown to have a particularly negative impact on GDP per capita. So we want investment and growth in the state. I think the corporate income tax rate and reducing that certainly plays a role. I think it would send a real important signal to companies around the country and around the world that are looking for places to invest. Third, the Small Business Investment Act. As Mr. Cassidy just mentioned, this is a proposal that is a good way to get a pool of capital in Minnesota to invest in small companies. We have a program at the Chamber called Grow Minnesota, where Bill Blazer of our staff goes out and with the local Chamber partners visits about 700 to 800 companies a year throughout the state of Minnesota, talks to the CEO or the plant manager and really asks them what will it take for you to grow in Minnesota, stay here, invest more, employ more people. And numerous times we've found a shortage or a need of capital. Sometimes it's when a business succession is going to take place, where an owner of a small company, most likely in greater Minnesota is where we've seen this, he'd like to have that plant stay in the community and find other local investors or pass it on to family members. And a pool of capital like this would certainly help that transition take place. So, again, I think it's an important proposal for small companies, and we certainly support it. And then finally, the Section 179 expensing. When we talked to some of our accounting folks, they love federal conformity, and as it was mentioned previously, it is important for smaller companies to expense that right away, especially in this economy. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Question for Mr. Hussey. Rep. Carlson.
Madam Chair, could you expand a little bit on your comments relative to the corporate tax effective rate versus statutory rate?
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative Carlson. The research that was presented, at least one of the research findings that was presented to the Governor's 21st Century Tax Commission, focused on the impact of the corporate income tax rate, not the statutory rate, not the effective rate, so not after deductions and credits are taken into effect. And I believe the result was that foreign direct investment in a state falls by one percentage point for each percentage point increase in the state corporate income tax rate.
A follow-up, so any thoughts on the corporate statutory rate were dropped and it was done in a revenue-neutral way and there were fewer tax credits then available? That was the one that asked the other day, I think you were in the audience, about how that all netted out. Looked at how much was raised with the corporate tax and then how much was given out in the form of tax credits. And understanding that some businesses went and some rose under that, but if you could give me your thoughts on your approach, because we all know we have revenue problem as well. And, one way to approach it would be to make it revenue neutral, but what I'm asking you is if you were revenue neutral within the various business incentive kind of credits for the corporate tax rate.
Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, I think the deductions and credits that are currently in law are also important and help keep some companies here to employ lots of high-wage workers in research and development and in other fields. I don't think the Minnesota Chamber would support getting rid of those features in order to reduce the rate. I think those are also important, especially in light of the high differential between the combined state and federal corporate income tax rate versus that of other countries.
I'm not proposing that, but I think it's got to be part of the discussion so that people really understand what we're talking about when we talk about statutory rate and effective rate, because both of those issues should be on the table when we're talking about the taxes on the community. Both are told in the time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hesse.
Appreciate it.
Ms. Larson, welcome. Another person who's been sitting here day after day. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Jill Larson. I represent the Minnesota Business Partnership. For those of you that don't know, the partnership is made up of about 100 CEOs of the state's largest employers. So I'm just going to focus on a couple of the provisions in the governor's proposal that affect large employers, and I'm not going to repeat much of what was said by Commissioner Innes and also Mr. Hesse, but I do want to go on the record that the business partnership does support the governor's proposal to reduce the corporate tax, as well as going to an upfront capital equipment exemption. As Commissioner Innes mentioned, the capital equipment exemption is not as big of a deal for larger employers. They usually have the staff available to do the paperwork to file for the refund. But as was mentioned earlier, I think it would be a better use of both taxpayers' time and revenue department staff people's time to use those resources in a better way than to be filing refund forms. And it's a very costly administrative complex provision. On the corporate tax, Our position is that even though we are in a very bad economic situation with a very large budget deficit, that we like the governor's proposal because it looks to the future. And in terms of reducing the corporate tax rate, it is forward-looking in that it assumes, and I think correctly, that we will come out of this recession eventually. And when we do, businesses will be looking to grow. And when they look around to see where they want to grow, we want them to grow here. We want to expand plants here. We want them to grow jobs here. We want them to move employees here. And so by sending the message that we're going to reduce the cost of doing business for employers in Minnesota by reducing the rate over several years, we think that sends a good message. Our employers do long-term planning in terms of their business model. And if they know that the state is committed to reducing the cost of doing business in Minnesota, I think we will get more investment here. We will get more capital coming into Minnesota. We've seen from what's happened in other countries and other states, when that corporate tax has been reduced in other countries, there has been a large infusion of capital in those countries. And so while it might not be the panacea for a very short-term fix right now, I think it's the right thing to do. The question is, how do we want to position Minnesota for growth in the future? And we think this is the governor's corporate tax proposal is one way to do that. The last thing I want to say, and this was mentioned by Mr. Loftus, is as we all know, we are in fierce competition for jobs in this state. My members get solicited daily by other states and, frankly, more so by other countries to move employees to expand, to put plants in other countries. And they're sometimes given very lucrative tax incentives to do that. And we need to be cognizant of that in Minnesota. I think you're going to have a bill before you in a few days that has to do with enterprise zones for Taylor's Falls. And you're going to listen to that mayor talk about that. I think Taylor's Falls has lost something like 7 businesses to St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin in the last year. Some of that is due to the property tax differential, but some of it is also due to the fact that Wisconsin is very aggressively going to our businesses and saying, come here, we have a lower corporate tax rate, we have lower business property taxes. That's happening border to border, but for the members that I represent, it's happening from the U.S. border to European countries. So I think we need to look further than just the short-term budget situation and look at how can we position Minnesota for growth in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Ms. Larson. So we've heard some testimony that corporate income tax rates are a significant factor, and we've kind of been all over the board with small companies or angel investment, you know, is one strategy. But for the really big employers, where is corporate income tax rate relative to, let's say, personal income tax rates, which for a big service company might have a larger bearing on their overall cost structure than even their corporate taxes? Are there other things that are more important, or is the corporate tax rate really the one thing you'd zero in on for our big Fortune 1000 companies?
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, that's a good question, and I will say it probably does depend a little bit on the company. I have heard from some of our members that the fact that we have a high personal income tax here does serve as sometimes a deterrent, other times just as another issue they have to resolve when they're trying to recruit top-level people to come here, because somebody will look at their tax burden from where they're living now versus what it would be if they were to move to Minnesota, and that has to be reconciled. And so some of my members have said that the high income tax is an issue that they look at in terms of a problem for recruiting. The issue with the corporate tax, I think, is because the rate is so high. When you've got these site selection folks looking at where do we move, and they look at that high rate, and they're looking at, or frankly, the deal they can get other places, that does have a big impact. And, you know, they're having their tax folks basically go out and do these analyses as, you know, do we move the plant to Iowa, or do we expand it here in Minnesota? And they're going to work the numbers, and when the bottom line is, because we've got a 9.8% rate here, and Texas has a 0% rate, you know, sometimes the decision sort of made for them.
Representative Downey?
No.
Others? Okay. Ms. Larson,
thank you.
Other public testifiers on the business chunk of the governor's proposal? Members, we do intend now, it looks like we're kind of getting through them. We're going to have Ms. Templin show us the price tag for all these when we're done with this section. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Wayne Cox. I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice. And we're a tax and budget research organization here in St. Paul. We're supported by Minnesota FLCO, a number of other labor unions here in the state. Let me just focus in on principally on the corporate income tax provision and the governor's proposal. We don't support the changes that the governor is proposing for a number of reasons. Number one, we think it's a solution in search of a problem. There's been analysis done about Minnesota's government-imposed business costs compared to other states. When you take the corporate income tax, you take the property tax for businesses, you take government-imposed costs through regulation, and you add them all up. What the people who have been studying it recently have found that Minnesota is roughly in the middle of the pack in terms of comparing with other states in terms of all government-imposed costs. So we don't really have a problem in terms of businesses facing a much, much higher total cost burden in Minnesota than we do in other states. You can take the corporate income tax rate, and if you look at it just as the rate, it seems it's higher than most states, certainly. If you look at, that's fairly misleading. It's like going to the store and looking at the tag on the store that lists the manufacturer's suggested retail price. And then it lists various other discounts that the store provides and whatnot. If you really want to do a fair analysis of what businesses pay, you don't look at the sticker price, manufacturer suggested retail price. You look at what they paid the cashier for that transaction. And what they pay the cashier is much smaller than the 9.8%. That is the nominal rate. Because of the existence of a whole variety of ways to reduce that tax through the law in terms of various credits, various deductions, and sometimes various other, sometimes questionable accounting practices that the businesses can apply. So, in the first place, it's not really we're not really that much different from other states in the effective tax rate, the actual tax rate paid for corporations. And secondly, if you put it in a total package, we're basically pretty much in line with most other states in terms of that. So to our way of thinking, it's a solution in search of a problem. Now, Minnesota businesses are struggling in the state right now. And we agree with the governor that it is something that the state ought to be concerned with, the legislature ought to be concerned with. But we think that part of the provision is going to make the situation worse, and here's why. In order to come up with the revenue this biennium to do this tax reduction, basically, where would that money come from? It would have to come from reductions in state spending under the governor's plan, because he's not providing any other alternative revenue to replace it. Well, what happens when you reduce state spending? Well, basically, what you do is you end up taking people that are now on the payroll, people who are receiving checks by providing government services or by providing health services that are paid for in part by the state government, or providing services provided by a nonprofit paid for in part by the state government. You end up losing a lot of those jobs or reducing the paychecks on a lot of those jobs. The net effect, we think, of his plan in the short term is going to make the economy in Minnesota worse by adding to the unemployment rolls, by taking more and more paychecks off of Main Street that the businesses on Main Street, like the baker, like the insurance company, like the car sales people, rely on those paychecks to be able to have customers to buy their products. So if you reduce the number of paychecks or you diminish them, you're going to make it tougher for the businesses that we have in Minnesota to make ends meet. Federal government, luckily, is stepping in and is going to try to induce some more demand by adding more paychecks, and that will help some, but I don't think we want to make Minnesota's situation even worse by having any more cuts than we need to have to make our budget situation worse. The last thing I want to say about it is that if it were financed in a fiscally sound way, maybe some of this wouldn't be a problem. But after this first biennium, there's no provision for replacement revenue or replacement spending cuts to deal in future bienniums. This plan has huge tails on it. It simply is going to exacerbate Minnesota's structural imbalance into the future and is very fiscally unsound way to go about things, particularly when the economy is in such an iffy situation to begin with. So we don't think you want to put Minnesota deeper in the hole into the future, and we don't think you want to, we would advise you not to to have the cuts be deeper now than they would have to be and trigger the reduction in demand in the short term. And we think that, in short, it's not really a problem that merits the level of this type of a response. So we would urge you to pursue the track that you've been pursuing over the years, which is to think about the possibility of reducing the rate, but do it in a manner that doesn't have these byproducts, these side counterintuitive effects by raising the revenue through eliminating a lot of the loopholes, a lot of the credits, a lot of the deductions that are in the tax to begin with. For the conservatives in the room, that's how the great reform that was undertaken by Ronald Reagan occurred in 1986 when he took a look at a whole raft of federal tax provisions and said, look, we can have a more efficient tax code if we eliminate a lot of the deductions, a lot of the loopholes, a lot of the tax preferences, and lower the rate in company with that. And that became law and was a very, very kind of a high watermark of tax policy improvement that has been going on the last few years. So we don't think that it's something you ought to be entertaining this year, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Yep. Thank you for being here. And we do want to get to the price tags as well. Are there other public testifiers on these business issues? And while we're going to see if they're rest and less. Okay. Ms. Templin, can you join us? And we want to get done on time. Was there someone else? I don't know if I missed it. Doug Sunbrod, I'm sorry. And then we'll get to you in just a minute. Do you want me to bring them back down? Okay. Okay, so Ms. Templin, and remember, this is the where the rubber hits the road. If everyone can look at this, which we've had in our pack for a long time, if you don't have it, then the pages do. Correct, Megan? You have some. Okay. So this way we can finish the whole business part today. Members have had, we've had four full meetings on them, and now we're going to have Ms. Templin tell us what they cost. It looks like this. Okay, does everyone have that? If you don't, they're coming around. Do you have that one, Ms. Templin? And as the commissioner said, in fairness, I think some of these are a little in flux because depending what the Congress just did, they may up or scale or downscale or drop some things. But this is what it looks like they cost as proposed by the governor. So are we all to that point now? So, Ms. Templin, we're looking at about the first page and a quarter is what we want to walk through and have you take us to the bottom line on that first page and a quarter.
For the record, again, I'm Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff, and we'll be going through that just the tax revenue changes that the governor has proposed. We compiled this spreadsheet, which is based on the Minnesota Management and Budget documents, and compiled the proposals that are within the jurisdiction of this committee. Madam Chair, my plan is to just look at the biennial totals, and if you have specific questions about an individual fiscal year, please stop me.
Ms. Templin, can you again remind people, unlike all the other committees, mm-hmm. What a positive number and what a negative number means? Because the only committee that thinks this way, so it's hard for people to get back in their tax spreadsheet mode. So Ms. Templin, if you could go through that again.
Madam Chair, on line 6 of the spreadsheet, just as a reminder, the positive numbers reflect revenue gains, the negative numbers reflect revenue reductions. So with that, on line 10, the governor's federal conformity recommendations in fiscal 10 and 11, a revenue loss of $6.1 million in 10 and 11, and a positive of revenue gain of $7.55 million. In fiscal 12 and 13. Moving on to spreadsheet on line 13, the job reinvestment refundable tax credit, the governor proposes, this proposal costs $50 million, or it is a revenue loss of $50 million in 10 and 11, and there's no cost in the tails. Section 179, expensing full conformity, and this is, again, the governor's proposal before the federal bill passed, or before it was agreed upon. The cost is $15.2 million, with a revenue gain of $8 million in 12 and 13. The job creation investment tax credit, there are no costs, there's no revenue impact in 10 and 11. The revenue impact is in the tails in 12 and 13 at $6 million. And there's also, the governor proposes this, I believe, for 4 years, so there is an additional cost in 14 and 15, and you don't see that on the spreadsheet because it's outside the forecast budget window. Line 16, the capital gains exemption for qualifying investments in small businesses. This is the proposal where there is a 5-year holding period that the commissioner spoke about today. We do not see any cost in either the current biennium or the tailed biennium because of this 5-year holding period. And we presume there will be costs in 14 and 15. We are awaiting a revenue estimate on this specific proposal that may shed light on what those costs may be in 14 and 15. Line 20 of the spreadsheet shows the governor's franchise tax rate reduction from 9.8% to 4.8%. In the current biennium, the cost of this proposal or the revenue impact is $120 million, and in 12 and 13, the cost is $410 million. We do have a revenue estimate from the department that has just a preliminary projection of what the cost could be in 14 and 15, and that is $670 million. And that's not on the spreadsheet because it's outside of the budget forecast window. Line 21, the Section 179 expensing. Again, this is just the corporate the corporate side and the cost. It's $3.7 million in 10 and 11 and a revenue gain of $1.4 million in 12 and 13. Moving on to the spreadsheet, line 25 is an interaction impact, and this has to do with the other side of the spreadsheet, and we haven't really talked about the governor's proposed property tax changes, but the governor's proposals have income tax and corporate tax revenue interaction, and in 10 and 11, the estimated impact is $12.6 million, a revenue loss, and in 12 and 13, the revenue impact is $21.1 million. And moving on to line 29, the capital equipment upfront exemption. The general fund impact in 10 and 11 is $74.9 million, and that's for an effective date of January 1, 2010. If that effective date was changed up to the beginning of a fiscal year, the cost would be much higher. And then in fiscal 12 and 13, the revenue impact of the capital equipment upfront exemption is $21.8 million. I am going to skip line 31 because that is a non-general fund impact, unless there are questions on that. And line 34 of the spreadsheet is the Green V program that we heard today. The cost in 10 and 11 is $3.6 million, and in 12 and 13 it's $6.6 million. And then the line 35, the small business tax credit, again we heard that discussed today, and the costs are shifted out until 12 and 13, and that is $25.6 million of revenue loss projected. The total of all these proposals of the governor's general fund recommendations in the current biennium is a revenue reduction or a revenue loss of $287.2 million, and in the tails, the revenue impact is $467.6
million. Okay, so thank you, Ms. Templin. Members, I think the line to really focus on now is the line 37 that Ms. Templin just finished. And if I can ask Mr. Inez to join us again before we adjourn for today, because we'll do the property taxes next. This member is just for framing now, and I would like the commissioner, and we may still need Ms. Templin here with questions, but just, I don't want to put words in the governor's mouth, and I want to be as fair as I can possibly be in this statement, but members looking at line 37 now, knowing this is going to change a little, you know, $287 million cost in this biennium, $467 in the next one, probably a couple hundred more in the next to follow through on, you know, the plan here. I think this is the right frame for members of the tax committee to think about this. Obviously, we don't have a target yet, but when we do have a target, if we want to do these things, then we have to find that money. And I know that the 21st Century Commission is going to report to us next week, and they've proposed, you know, raising the cigarette tax, expanding the sales tax base, and we'll have that discussion with them next week. But is it a fair characterization to say what the governor is saying, how he's paying for this, is in a combination of deeper cuts elsewhere in the budget and, not trying to use a pejorative here, shifts or one-time money? Is that an accurate, you know, I mean, just how is the governor saying we should come up with this $467 million? Because this is the part where the tax committee knows we have to pay for tax cuts around here. So, Commissioner, if you can just sort of sum up his thought for all of us in thinking this through. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I think you've actually accurately captured his thought process on this. These tax reductions, these revenue reductions, are the function of spending cuts and or a combination of one-time shifts, utilization of one-time revenues. That's accurate. That's how he's paying for this. And he prioritized these higher than some spending cuts. He thought, I'd rather have to do additional spending cuts in order to free up some money, some revenue for tax reduction. And so I think this is an accurate reflection of his priorities.
And Commissioner, can you just opine, it's not fair, speculation, if the deficit is 7 or some other number, you have any sense the governor is going to abandon this, or is he going to, do you have any idea where he'd go to find this, you know, this money if things get worse?
Madam Chair, I think it's too early to tell. And as you all know, there's many moving parts right now with the federal stimulus package. We don't know what the delta is going to be, whether it's going to be $7 billion. And after you factor in the federal stimulus package, who knows what the final net will be. I will say this, though. when we were doing our prioritizing during the course of the budget, coming together with the budget, the things on these pages were high priorities for him. And I'm certain they're not the first thing that's going to fall off the table if the squeeze comes. I think there's other things that were lower priorities that were still being funded that he would probably fall off the table prior to abandoning these tax reductions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling and Carlson and Representative Downey. Representative Liebling.
I had a question for Ms. Kepler, but I'll wait.
Okay, Representative Carlson and then Downey.
Madam Chair, a follow-up to your question, you know, when we referenced the federal stimulus package, it may provide some relief to this biennium, and we're in the process of trying to figure that out. But when I look at that 467 in the next biennium, what comes to mind is the stimulus package is one-time money. So we've delayed the situation when we try to address the question that you were raising, I think, Madam Chair, about the 467. And we're still trying to figure out what it would mean for this biennium. We'll hopefully have more information and try to find ways to meet finance committee meeting next week, where we're going to try to learn more about stimulus money. But the other thing that plays into this whole question, Madam Chair, is that forgetting for a moment the federal part of this, the governor's budget in and of itself, with the exception of that 920 million that was built into the federal stimulus package, which is the best yet, is 71% one-time money. So we've really got some major issues that are out there just hanging, if you will, relative to how all this interplays and how that revenue, at least in my view, could be used to help offset the deficit that we have that everybody seems to agree is growing. And to what, we don't know yet. We won't know until March 3rd, I guess.
Mr.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I really can't add much to it. You're right. You're right. And I guess one of the concerns the governor has, and probably many of us around this table, is that the federal stimulus may provide a short-term salve or band-aid to some of the immediate deficit we're confronted with. And our, you know, it may enable us to meet our constitutional obligation to balance the budget in 10 and 11, but that out biennium is the nut that's going to be very difficult to crack, the more difficult nut, as you know. So that would be the challenge. But based on the priorities I was privy to when we were putting the budget together, and of course, Commissioner Hansen's portfolio is much broader than mine. I'm the tax person. It was clear to me that these recommendations were a high priority for him. And that's not saying some of them won't fall off the table if the deficit gets dramatically worse. But I expect, and I wouldn't be in any position to name what are lower priorities at this point. But
well, go ahead.
I think I better steer clear of that. You want to hear that, you better call Commissioner Hansen in. But I do know that he really felt compelled to do something on the tax front because he's very concerned that what we were going to do was a short-term fix. He knew federal dollars were going to be coming probably in February or March. And he was very concerned about just bandaging the problem short-term and not providing any long-term vision about positioning ourselves to make us more competitive down the road. And so what I had personal knowledge of, I would expect most of these to stick in the supplemental budget.
Thank you. Representative Downey, and then we're going to do property taxes tomorrow. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hopefully this isn't too long a question. I'm just curious, the $467 million out in the subsequent biennium, does that flatten out then? Is if we were to project this thing out over four biennia, would this 467 stay to accelerate? Do these things kind of kick in an accelerating way that the impact is even greater 6, 8, 10 years from now?
Mr. Madam Chair, Representative Downey, I'd have to get back to you on that. I'm not exactly sure what the long term is beyond the 4 years. By that point, the corporate franchise tax reduction won't be fully phased in to 4.8% at that point. So there will be substantial tails even beyond the budgeting horizon we're looking at in front of us. I guess the question you have to ask yourself, is that loss of revenue going to generate economic development and other things that are going to be more than a net gain for the state as a whole? And our answer is a definitive yes. We believe this is the appropriate way to go and that it will be a net benefit over the long term. But when you look at the spreadsheet, it's an intimidating number. There's no question about it. That's a substantial tails number.
Thank you. Thanks
just
for the question.
Write them down. Real quick follow-up then. So, and this has been something that I've been trying to get used to here in state government is this notion of static budgeting. So do you have models somewhere, even though we perhaps can't budget off of them, that show some of the net impacts, kind of the value side and the return on these investments that we're making, that give us some confidence that 4, 6, 8 years from now, these investments do pay off and we, in fact, have increased revenues from other revenue streams that are driven by these investments?
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, the Department of Revenue doesn't have a dynamic model within our department, but I know the Department of Employment and Economic Development does have access to a revenue model, which is the kind of modeling we do a dynamic, and you try to determine how much wage growth would be, how many jobs would be created. Their forte in modeling that, they have the capacity to do it. Their forte in modeling it usually is if we bring in this employer, what's the ancillary benefits, what's the multiplier effect. They've done some limited modeling, I believe, on taxes. And that's a possibility. That's something we've talked about, running a revenue model on some of the proposal in front of us. We have not done that yet, but there is a model like that out there that we can do the multiplier effect and really find out what the dynamic net revenue impact is. The last time I remember it being utilized in this debate, legislative debate, was during single sales apportionment. The University of Chicago was contracted to do a model that determined how many jobs would be created if you went to a single sales apportionment formula. And I think that was, it wasn't built into the revenue estimate, but it was certainly part of the discussion and part of the evidence, the case to go to a different apportionment formula. And I think it was fairly persuasive.
Representative Downey, as frustrating as government is, I think Minnesota really is ahead of the game in that we actually look out 4 years.
Yeah.
So we even see these numbers in what we call the planning estimate. We have to balance in 2 years, and some states only have 1 year budgeting still. There are states that do 2 years like us, but we actually look at four and we build a 4 year planning estimate into our forecast. So we're probably doing better than most states, even though it might not seem like it. Representative Loom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my question was really largely covered by Representative Downey, and my experience was more from the federal model, which I don't know that we necessarily want to emulate, but again, with looking at the scoring and how we can pinpoint which of those tax provisions could be most effective in Minnesota's economy for generating really job growth is what we're talking about, and then the revenue that comes from that. So I would just encourage the commissioner more as a comment than a question to continue to pursue those models, because I think it really is the kind of information that lawmakers and others need when looking at these provisions.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, Representative Loon, point is well taken. I'll huddle with my colleagues at Deed and see what ability we have to do a revenue model on some of these provisions. Give you some feedback on that. It'd be helpful.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment going back to what I was saying earlier, the 4.67 million, whatever it was. I mean, 400. Remember, keep in mind that that's not built into the forecast. So when we get into the outlying units, the forecast for each November shows a 2.5 million shortfall. And as we do this, then we've got a 2 billion dollar problem. Depending on the discussion from the other side of the table, that at this point in time, we don't know the answer to in terms of what economic development or growth that might build in. We just don't have an answer to that. But we do certainly have an answer, at least based on the November forecast, and we'll get started with March numbers on the 3rd of March, I think it's the date that comes out. So it fits that out by any means.
We're over time, but we're going to get Representative Broad in here. We just love talking to you about the governor's budget. We're even over, and we're still doing it.
I was just going to say, I think that this discussion is really important. I actually think that we should be balancing our budget for 4 years, not just talking about it or looking at it or thinking about it. So I hope that maybe we can move in that direction and Minnesota can become a leader in that. But we have to keep in mind, too, that even last year's budget or the last budget didn't balance in the out years. So we shouldn't be surprised, even if the economy was moving in the right direction, we shouldn't be surprised that there's deficit on top of the deficit due to the economy moving the other direction, because we didn't balance it. So as good as we all felt about how things happened in the last couple of years, There was a big price tag sitting on Minnesota even before the economy started going the other direction. I just want to make sure that we're all thinking about it in the realm of we got to stop doing that.
And thank you, and pass that on to the governor, will you, please, Commissioner? So he's not balancing in 4 years either, but Representative Broad's right. There was $935 million left in the Alpianium. We are adjourned. Thank you.